Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today I'm speaking with Christopher Hedges, an American journalist, author and war correspondent specializing in American and Middle Eastern politics and societies. His most recent book is Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, published by Nation Books in July 2009. Chris is also known as the best-selling author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which was a finalist for the US National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction, published by Anchor in 2003. Chris Hedges is currently a senior fellow at the Nation Institute in New York City and has reported from more than 50 countries and has worked for many print publications, including the New York Times, where he was a foreign correspondent for 15 years. In 2002, Hedges was part of a team of reporters at the New York Times, which was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for the paper's coverage of global terrorism. He also received in 2002, the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. He's taught at Columbia University, New York University, and Princeton University, and currently writes a column for Truthdig. Chris Hedges, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you.
I've spent the last day reading all your articles from Truthdig. Do you put out an article every week?
Yes.
Boy, you're very, very prolific.
I don't have much of a life.
No, well, I wondered about that. you must be thinking even when you're dreaming. You've got so much.
It never turns off, you know, that's sort of the curse.
Yeah, I know that feeling. So when did you get turned on to all of these issues, the American society, war, fascism, etc. Was it when you were a war journalist? And tell us which countries you were covering when you worked for the New York Times.
Well, I would really trace my kind of awareness of the duplicitous and murderous effects of power to my childhood. My father was a veteran of World War II. He had been in North Africa as a sergeant with the U.S. Army, came back from the war, disgusted with the military, with war, with violence, and became a Presbyterian minister, and was very outspoken throughout my childhood. We grew up in a small farm town in upstate New York, no people of color, and my father, from the pulpit, supported the civil rights movement in the early 1960s. I was a small child then, but I can remember people walking out of his sermons. This was at a time when in rural white enclaves, Martin Luther King was one of the most hated men in America. My father then took a very strong stance against the war, again, very unpopular, at least at the early years of the Vietnam War. And finally, he was a very outspoken supporter of gay rights. His youngest brother, there were four brothers in his family, my uncle was gay, and lived with his partner in Greenwich Village. And my father had a particular sensitivity to the pain of being a gay man in America in the 1950s and the 1960s. And I think of all of the stances he took within the church, that was probably the most controversial. He was pushed out of congregations. So I watched my dad pay a price for a moral stance. And inevitably, that, as a child, makes you ask questions that perhaps other children are not asking. I went on to college, and when I graduated from college, went to seminary to be a minister like my father, but lived in a housing project in the black and Hispanic inner city, poor inner city section of Boston known as Roxbury for 2.5 years. So I had a kind of trajectory that led me into pockets of poverty, of violence, of deprivation. And I think it all stems from the upbringing that I had and the issues that I was forced to confront and think about at a very early age, including why so many people didn't like my father. I went to Latin America to cover the war in El Salvador for 5 years, first as a freelancer and then eventually for the Dallas Morning News, and then went from there to the Middle East. I took a sabbatical to study Arabic, was there for 7 years, was hired by the New York Times when I was there, went on to cover the first Gulf War when it was in Basra during the Shiite uprising, where I was finally taken prisoner by the Iraqi Republican Guard for 8 days, went on to Yugoslavia, and then in between these foreign assignments, I was overseas for almost 20 years, inevitably was sent off to cover other conflicts from the Punjab to the civil war in Yemen, civil war in Algeria, the civil war in the Sudan. I was in the southern Sudan for many weeks with the SPLA rebels at the height of the war. So outside of Asia, there weren't many major conflicts that I missed from the period of the early 80s until roughly the attacks on 9/11.
My God. Did you have a family at the time?
Yes. Not until I got to the Middle East, and they were based in Cairo. I mean, I was living in Cairo, but I was, of course, traveling all throughout the Middle East. And then when I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, I was in Sarajevo during the war, and my family was in Zagreb in Croatia.
Boy. Your father, was he recognized at any stage of his life for the outstanding positions that he took on the most controversial issues at the time?
No, and I think that in fact, was a really important lesson for me, in that I understood that to take a moral stance, that you were not rewarded for taking a moral stance, that virtue was its own reward, but the world outside was not going to reward you. That's not always the case, but it's often the case. And I think that in fact, was a very almost comforting realization, and because, of course, I measure my own life by the standards that my father set. When I went to a small liberal arts college in upstate New York called Colgate University.
Yes, I've spoken.
And by
there.
Then,
yeah.
Oh, okay. My father by then had a church in Syracuse, which was an hour away.
Mm.
And when my dad found out there was no gay and lesbian organization at Colgate, he brought the gay and lesbian speakers to the university, and would have meetings with students to promote, a kind of understanding for other ways of being. And this eventually led to gays and lesbians confiding in my father that they were too uncomfortable in that environment to come out publicly and found a gay and lesbian alliance. So my dad drove down one day, took me to lunch, and told me, although I wasn't gay, that I had to found it. So I founded the Gay and Lesbian Alliance at Colgate, although I never went. And I used to go into the dining hall, and the guy would take my card to check it off for breakfast, lunch, or dinner and hand it back and go, faggot.
Oh, God.
I made it my undergraduate mission to seduce his girlfriend.
And did you do it?
I don't know. I don't think it was worth it.
I had a
very acrimonious split with the New York Times because I had been the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, and I was publicly denouncing the Bush calls for the invasion of Iraq. Like most Arabists, I speak Arabic. I understood that we would not be greeted as liberators, that democracy was not going to be implanted in Baghdad and emanate outwards across the Middle East, that the oil revenues were not going to pay for the reconstruction. But to make that kind of a public stance was one that cost me my career. And I knew when I was doing it, I'd been at the New York Times 15 years, what the price of this was. And I was finally, after I was booed off of a commencement stage in Rockford College, which you can watch on YouTube, the paper issued me a formal written reprimand. And we were GILD, which or unionized, which was the process whereby the next time I spoke out about the war, I would be fired. And I can remember going into the office on 229 West 43rd Street in New York, and I can't pretend that that was an easy moment. But as I sat there and received this reprimand, I understood that I had a choice, and that choice was that I could muzzle myself and pay fealty to my career, but to do so would be to betray my dad, and I couldn't do that. And I remember walking out of the building and realizing that my father had been dead for some time, but realizing that the gift that my father had given me was freedom. I think it was only at that moment that I understood the legacy that I'd been handed and the beauty of that legacy.
Did he die a broken man or a proud, upstanding man, knowing that he'd done exactly the right thing all his life?
No, he did not die a broken man.
Good.
He died a man of tremendous dignity and pride who, I think in the case of the gay rights movement, he just saw in the struggle of gays and lesbians the struggle of his own brother.
Yeah.
His brother was disowned by the family.
Oh,
and the only,
no, really?
Yes, it was awful. And the only relationship left within the family was between my father and his little brother.
Oh.
And Jamie, his name was Jamie, was incorporated into our family along with his partner.
Yeah.
And we were the only family he had. And my father had that amazing capacity not to particularize injustice, but to see in the injustice that had been visited upon someone that he loved very dearly, the injustice visited on all who are marginalized and oppressed. And he didn't. And you know what? By that time, he'd watched me. He'd watched all of everything that he had lived for, because I think you finally only teach ethics by example,
mm-hmm.
Not by lectures or not by it's to this day, my father stands as a kind of invisible witness to everything that I do, mm-hmm. and he sets the standards by which I carry out my own life, and as long as I meet those standards. And, you know, when I denounced this war in Iraq in a very public way, it's the only time, certainly in the United States, that I've ever received death threats. It was a very lonely position. People forget that the sort of chorus, the cheerleading that went on, even among so-called liberals within the United States for this war. It was a very, very lonely position, but I think that I was fortified in everything that I did by understanding that I remained true to the values that my father had imparted to me, and that gave me a tremendous amount of self-satisfaction, of dignity, of independence, and saved me from needing the acclamation of the herd.
Your father really walked in the shoes of the fisherman, didn't he? In all respects.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that. You know, when you take a moral stance, there's always a cost, and if there isn't a cost, it's usually not moral. There are certain issues, moral issues, that after the fact become accepted within
uh-huh.
the broad mainstream of society,
uh-huh.
and people will use those stances to paint themselves as moral. But always, for me, the true test of the moral stance is, and you go back to the prophets, Amos, Isaiah, Jeremiah, those who carry that banner of justice are often, certainly for long stretches of their lives, very lonely and often reviled figures.
Yep. What did you exactly did you say on the stage of that commencement address that caused you to be booed?
Well, I denounced the war.
Yeah. Did you walk off the stage or stayed there?
No, I stayed. They cut my microphone twice.
Did they?
I was booed and jeered. At one point, the crowd stood up and started singing God Bless America. Oh. Many people were weeping.
Oh.
Towards the end of 18 minutes, two young men in their graduation gowns got up on the stage and tried to push me off the podium. Mm. And security had to push them back. I was escorted off of the platform by campus security before the awarding of diplomas in the middle of the ceremony.
Good Lord.
And taken to, I had my jacket in the president's office. I said, my jacket's in the president's office. They said, we'll mail it to you. And they took me down to my hotel, stood with me while I packed my bag, drove me to the bus station, and put me on a bus to Chicago. But what I said was, and I'll read you just a couple lines. Here I began the address. I want to speak to you today about war and empire. The killing, or at least the worst of it, is over in Iraq, although blood will continue to spill, theirs and ours. Be prepared for this. For we are embarking on an occupation that, if history is any guide, will be as damaging to our souls as it will be to our prestige, power, and security. But this will come later as our empire expands. And in all this, we become pariahs, tyrants to others weaker than ourselves. Isolation always impairs judgment, and we are very isolated now. We have forfeited the goodwill, the empathy the world felt for us after 9/11. We have folded in on ourselves. We have severely weakened the delicate international coalitions and alliances that are vital in maintaining and promoting peace. And we are part now of a dubious troika in the war against terror with Vladimir Putin and Ariel Sharon, two leaders who do not shrink in Palestine or Chechnya from carrying out gratuitous and senseless acts of violence. We have become the company we keep.
Oh, boy. What year was that?
2003. Bush had landed in that horrible photo op on the aircraft carrier with the mission accomplished banner behind him 2 weeks before I gave that address.
Yeah. Well,
and the mood of the country was sick. It was triumphalist and filled with nationalist cant and militarized rhetoric about power and force. It was, the whole country was on a bender of self-exaltation and intoxication with the use of violence.
Yes. I remember when I had to address 40,000 people at Foxborough, Massachusetts, during the first Gulf invasion, and I followed Jesse Jackson, and it was sort of a bitter cold sort of early spring day, and I didn't know what I was going to say, and I stood up at the microphone and I said, "You don't kill children for oil." And the next thing, the whole crowd stood up and booed me for about 5 minutes. It was like waves and waves and waves of booing. And I came off the platform and then I explained, you know, what they were doing to the children. And people rushed up and said, "I'm so sorry, the organizers." And I said, "Don't worry." And I went back to the hotel. I drank champagne and watched a couple of films. And I felt like someone who'd been in Nazi Germany standing up and telling the Germans that Hitler was wicked. And I felt really profoundly good.
Right. Well,
so I know that feeling, and I've been booed off the not off the stages, but when I've done commencement addresses too, talking about war. There's something about war, Chris, and I've got an article that here in front of me that you wrote called War is a Hate Crime. And you just described how war and vengeance brings a nation together in a sort of tribalistic immorality, and people who are enemies or they don't like their next door neighbors can unite under the banner of hatred of another sort of tribe in a way. Do you think that's a sociobiological phenomenon, Chris? What do you think it is?
I think there's a kind of deep attraction to the crowd, and wars are crowd phenomena. The power of war, at least at its inception, is that, especially to people alienated and atomized within modern society, it can look and feel like love. which of course is the chief emotion that war destroys. But it looks and feels like love because suddenly you connect, or it's a false connection, but you believe that you connect with everyone around you. There's a kind of egalitarianism that comes with having with a common enemy. Nationalism is, in essence, about self-exaltation, and the flip side of nationalism is always racism, the elevation of ourselves and the denigration of the other.
Mm.
If you watch on American cable news shows, when you go to war, it's a raw, naked celebration of the power of our weaponry and, by extension, our own power. And this is very appealing to people who feel disconnected, as I think most people are disconnected in a modern society. And it's why, so-called social critics and intellectuals are often just as enticed by this poison as everyone else.
Yeah.
So I think that it comes from an emotional and psychological impoverishment. It's repeated in war after war. I mean, people forget that even at the inception of World War I, you had brilliant intellectuals like Freud and Thomas Mann writing in they changed eventually, but in the first few months of the war, about how this, which was certainly World War I being one of the most senseless slaughters in human history, about how this was a kind of would be a purging, a cleansing of European society. It's just amazing to me how, the numbers of people throughout economic and intellectual classes that get seduced by this.
Mm.
It requires, a kind of, not necessarily intellectual, but an emotional fortitude, the ability to sort of stand alone. Which is a kind of rare characteristic because it's almost counterintuitive in a sense that, I mean, if you look at this as a kind of primal force, when you have an external enemy, fictitious or otherwise, there is a kind of retreat into the crowd for security and safety. And, of course, the whole engine of permanent war is based on fear, making us afraid. And the systems of mass propaganda have done a very good job at this since the end of World War I, whether it's the communist or the red or the fascist or the Islamo-terrorist or whoever it is. If you keep people afraid, you disempower them politically. But more importantly, you ensure that kind of ability to herd the country or the population in the direction that you want. And that, of course, is what has destroyed American democracy.
Yeah. Let me tell you an instance that I experienced just as George I was going to invade Iraq the first time. I was invited, it was just before the war, to a group of bankers. There must have been about 90 by a man who ran Barclays Bank in Sydney, and they were all men. A few women sat on the side, but they were all men. And I started to describe exactly what you've been talking about, but more from, as I am a physician, the medical perspective of war and what it really means, and you've written about it so beautifully yourself. And the hostility was unbelievable. Finally, I just said, I'm going to leave. I'm not going to put up with this. The anger they had towards me, the vehemence, and it was as if they already had the scent of blood in their nostrils before it had already happened. And there was nothing I could say to these men about babies being torn apart by shrapnel and the like that would change their minds. And I often wondered afterwards, well, when it actually happened, did they ever think, well, she might have been right? Have you come across that incredible, frenzied, primitive response that particularly men have and women do not participate, but, and I think they probably don't agree, but they haven't got the guts to stand up to the men?
Yeah, I think that's it's extremely interesting and terrifying because a deep visceral hatred is precisely what I invoked in the in my denunciations of the plans to invade Iraq. And you know, let me be clear. I spent months of my life in Iraq. You know, I understand the instrument of war. I've been in far more combat than most people in the military. And that is exactly what I evoked. I would come into the office at the New York Times, and there would I was just stunned at the rage.
Really?
You know, the deep rage of the messages, and you know, the people, you know, leaving messages about how I should just be annihilated and, you know, eviscerated, and I was a traitor. And I think that
you mean amongst your colleagues or messages?
No, these were people who would leave phone messages, anonymous phone messages.
Yeah.
Or I would be mailed anonymous death threats.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wrote a book about the Christian right, which was pretty brutal, called American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War on America. I never received death threats for that. It was death threats for denouncing the kind of militaristic cant, the drumbeat for war. And I think that that rage stemmed from the fact that by challenging the sanctity of this conflict and our right to, you know, because we have the capacity to wage war, somehow we have the right to wage war. That fusion of sort of violence with virtue. I think that the anger stemmed from the fact that in an environment like that, many, many people who are otherwise disenfranchised emotionally, economically, and who are invited to participate in this crowd phenomena, and who find at least a temporary emotional satisfaction and a sense of empowerment, because many of these people don't have a sense of power, that by challenging that, the rage is triggered by someone, by a critic such as myself, who is at its core threatening to push them back into those marginalized corners of society, for which the war phenomena has at least given them the illusion now that they have been brought into the fold. That's sort of at least how I analyzed. But I was like you, I was stunned at the level of hatred that my criticisms brought. And these were criticisms based on deep personal experience, not only in war, and not only in the Middle East, but within Iraq itself. I wasn't an armchair pundit. It was a very lonely time. It was and the liberal class in this country was once again bankrupt. I mean, all the liberal critics who sort of crawled out to critique the war, at the inception of the war, were all calling for the war. It was only after the war went sour that they found the moral courage to say what they should have said a couple years
before. I can remember my experience in Foxborough when I said, "You don't kill children for oil," and that response the 40,000 people had. I rang the editors of the Boston Globe, with whom I was very close at the time. I think Tom Winship had left, but I knew the Globe very well. And I told them, and they displayed shock, but they didn't have the guts. They did not have the courage to publish what had actually happened. And that's obviously what you experienced at the Times.
Well, when I was booed off, pushed off the commencement stage, the local paper wrote, "Rockford College speaker disrupts graduation."
Oh, God, talk about war is peace and peace is war.
Oh, right.
tell us about Basra, because I followed that pretty closely, and the incidence now of childhood cancer and the very high incidence of severe congenital anomalies amongst the Basran population post 1991 war. And almost certainly the use of uranium weapons. I'd like your first-hand description. You were there. What did you experience? What did you see? Were you aware they were using radioactive weapons at the time? I wrote a book about the ghastly weapons they were using, like daisy cutters and fuel air explosives that ruptured people's lungs and sucked out their eyeballs. What exactly did you see, Chris Hedges?
Well, I was in Basra during the Shiite uprising. So when I was in Basra, there was just a lot of fighting, and then I was taken prisoner by a light armor battalion that was trying to punch its way through north to Baghdad. We didn't make it. We were ambushed for about 16 hours, 60 miles north of Basra. So in that initial period in Basra, it was just a lot of combat. But I stayed on in the Middle East after I was released. These uranium-depleted weapons, they use them in Bosnia. And when you found a crater from one of these uranium-depleted weapons, nothing grew. You could always tell where they were in the fields. It was just it killed all the plant life. One of the things the weapons does, and you know, you may know more about this than I, but I can just tell you, having seen it, you know, I saw the Highway of Death, that road leading north of Kuwait City into Iraq, where you had a long file of fleeing Iraqi troops that were bombed from the air. I mean, just a vehicle after vehicle, a charred wreck. And
how many vehicles and
it was
what
7
year
miles
was,
long. So you're talking
7 miles of vehicles. And what year was that?
Well, that was immediately after the at 91, immediately after the first.
They
Gulf
were trying
War.
To escape to Kuwait.
Yeah, they were trying to escape, and I mean, it was a gruesome sight. I mean, you know, the blackened bodies still sitting in the cabs, or bodies that had obviously been on fire that had tried to flee a few feet, and I mean, it was awful.
The Americans bombed them.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they were fleeing to Iraq. I mean, it was just murder. It was an act of murder, massive slaughter. But all they had obviously used uranium-depleted weapons because there was this powder.
Really?
This sort of grayish powder that had been left behind on the charred vehicles, which was the residue from these weapons. And many of the soldiers who came down with Gulf War syndrome were sent in to clean up the Highway of Death. And my guess is that they kicked up this dust and ingested it. When I went into Kuwait, into occupied Kuwait, I went in with the Marine Corps. Within the vehicles, there were sort of primitive counters that measured radiation.
Geiger counters.
Yeah, whatever they were.
Yeah.
And you know, they would sort of flip up into the red zone, and they would, without any noticeable sign of a change in the landscape, they would inevitably flip up and flip back. There was a constant kind of, there was clearly radioactive material in the atmosphere that was being picked up by these counters as they went into Kuwait. But I think that dust, and I know it's deadly because I saw what it did in Bosnia, and then, as you correctly point out, the residue of this seeps into groundwater and aquifers.
And food chains, children. Have you been following the medical reports from Basra about the children and the kids?
Not in detail, but I have heard, you know, of course, the facts that you've mentioned, that there is a huge increase in terms of,
in childhood cancer and and the half-life of uranium-238 happens to be 4.5 billion years. So, you know, they've decimated the cradle of civilization, really, in a certain way. Now, I did read Chris Hedges. Incidentally, I'm interviewing Chris Hedges, a fascinating person who was a journalist at the New York Times until he was forced to leave by writing honestly about war. I read in one of your articles that you became a vegetarian after seeing what war did and seeing so much flesh and body parts. Can you describe to us what you did see, please? I want people to really understand what war means.
Well, this was after Sarajevo, because when I was in Sarajevo, it was being hit with about 2,000 shells a day. And these were massive pieces of ordnance. They were 90-millimeter tank rounds, 155 howitzers, Katusha rockets, and
these
there was no running water.
American weapons.
Most of them were Soviet weapons.
Oh.
It was the Serb forces surrounding the city.
Right.
And Katushas are actually Russian. They're organ grinders. They're rockets, small rockets that are fired in bursts of a dozen or 24. That you literally hear them whoosh over your head in the city, and then they can take down a five-story apartment building in a matter of seconds, killing everyone inside.
God.
These 155 howitzers are, they're larger than watermelons. I mean, we're talking about huge shells here.
Mm.
And the explosive power of this ordnance is staggering. And because there was no running water, there were only about a dozen or so water taps, UN water taps, where people had to go to get water, and the Serb gunners knew just where these were, so they would fire these shells into crowds. And it was those explosions that just ripped bodies in half, entrails coming out of people's stomach, legs blown off with it, unfortunately, I know from personal experience that you can have your legs blown off and survive for 6 hours as you bleed to death. And it was seeing that, that kind of mangled flesh that I couldn't eat red meat after that.
Yeah. I've got another essay from you. I'll just read a little bit of it and I want you to comment. Our military, which swallows half of the federal budget, is enormously popular, as if it is not part of the government. The military values of hyper-masculinity, blind obedience and violence are an electrical current that run through reality television and trash talk programs where contestants endure pain while they betray and manipulate those around them in a ruthless world of competition. Friendship and compassion are banished. This hyper-masculinity is the core of pornography, with its fusion of violence and eroticism, as well as its physical and emotional degradation of women. It's an expression of the corporate state where human beings are reduced to commodities and companies have become proto-fascist enclaves devoted to maximizing profit. Militarism crushes the capacity for moral authority and difference. I'd like you to talk a little then, Chris Hedges, about the hyper-masculinity and which you can see in American football, Australian football, rugby, and its relationship with pornography and how sex and violence within the military seem fused and how it's used to get men to kill.
Well, having spent a lot of time around military units, the way military units speak about the sexual act is to reduce it to something that is crude and animalistic. It almost becomes an act equatable with defecation. All of the words that are used to describe sexual activity are words of violence and degradation towards women, a language that eschews the possibility of that anybody who is speaking about sexual relations could have felt tender or gentle or certainly in love. And smut and porn are very effective weapons against the capacity of sexual relations to expose a kind of human vulnerability. If you look at porn, I think the longest chapter in my book, Empire of Illusion, is on the porn industry, and I interview a lot of women who had currently work or have worked in. And porn has evolved into something very frightening, which is an attempt to eroticize violence. And it's not simulated violence. These women finish these shoots, and they're completely black and blue. They have to take painkillers even before they go on the set.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They are constantly going in for reconstructive surgery for vaginal and anal tears.
Good God.
The first woman I interviewed who had just left the porn industry was quite a well-known porn actress. I'm about 3 or 4 minutes into the interview, and I stop, and I recognize all of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, having suffered it myself. And this is what sells, and we're of course a completely pornified culture. The access to porn through the internet is, within the click of a mouse, within every household. It makes the porn industry, in terms of revenues, makes 4 or 5 times what Hollywood makes. And when you sit and watch this stuff, it's frightening. And the still photographs from Abu Ghraib look like stills from a gonzo porn shoot.
Oh.
After having studied the porn industry and then looking at those pictures, these are replications of porn. The bodies piled on top of each other.
Yeah.
The figures with the hands tied with the hoods. It's all out of porn. It's all out of the porn industry.
Really?
Oh yeah. And I think that it is, as you read in the article that I wrote, it's just a segment of a militarized culture, one of with this kind of sick hypermasculinity, which is really about the banishment of compassion.
Yeah.
And the eroticizing of violence and force. And I think that, there's a deep sickness that infects all imperial societies. I was a study classics in graduate school, and certainly ancient Rome was a perfect example of what happened. Cicero wrote quite a bit about it. And I think it's very similar that Freud had it, that there are two powerful elements, engines, yeah, in human existence, eros and thanatos. Mm-hmm. Eros being that capacity to nurture, preserve, protect life, and thanatos that calls for the annihilation of all living things, including, finally, the annihilation of ourselves. And I think in philosophical or religious terms, imperial powers become forces of death, not just literally in terms of what they do with their military power, but internally, what they do morally to the societies that become enamored of imperial violence. And boy, that goes right back to Thucydides, who wrote that, what killed Athenian democracy was that Athens became a tyrant abroad and then a tyrant at home, that the tyranny Athens imposed on others had finally imposed on itself. And I think that this is what American empire now, we're in the very late stages of committing collective suicide.
Mm. Mm. I'm reading a fascinating book now called The Female Brain, and the author, I just don't have a name at my fingertips at the moment, describes in the midbrain the two emotions that trigger the release of powerful morphine-like substances in the brain. One is sex, and obviously orgasm does that, and the other one is violence. In the male brain, they are side by side, the violence and the sexual neurofibers that stimulate the release of this incredibly powerful hormone. And so it's fascinating to me that intimately within the primitive midbrain lies this problem that we've just been discussing, particularly in men. So
yeah,
the two are related.
Well, yes. Having spent a lot of time in combat, I can tell you that they are intimately related.
Really? I know it's hard over the air because of the sort of rules that they have in America, but can you describe some of the words that the military uses to describe sex, per se, that are so revolting? Because I need to know that. What are they?
Well, it's the way they refer to women.
Yeah? How
slut,
do they?
Whore, bitch.
Really?
Yeah. And you know, language of violence is sexualized when you speak about carrying acts of violence.
Yeah.
You know, it is described in sexual terms.
Well, describe it. What do they
say? Well, let me quote the well-known New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman.
Yes.
It perfectly sums up the awful descent of the military culture. So let me just
Friedman, interviewed by Charlie Rose, spoke in the sexualized language of violence to justify the war in Iraq. Quote, "What they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house from Basra to Baghdad and basically saying, 'Which part of this sentence don't you understand?' Friedman said. 'You don't think, you know. We care about our open society. You think about this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow. Well, suck on this.' That, Charlie, was what this war was about. We could have hit Saudi Arabia. It was part of that bubble. We could have hit Pakistan. We could have hit Iraq because we could. I don't understand, actually. What does he mean, suck on this? You don't think...
Oh, it's a blowjob. It's like...
Oh, really?
Know, suck on me.
Yeah. I still don't understand. You don't think... You know, we care about our open society. What does that mean?
He's saying this is what they're saying to the Iraqis.
That they...
He's paraphrasing what soldiers are going house to house saying to Iraqis. You think we don't care about our open society? Well, what part of this do you don't understand? Suck on this.
And what's the bubble fantasy relating to? We're just...
The what?
He says, you think this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow. What's that?
Oh, that refers to something he said earlier about how it's typical Friedman, you know, jargon about how America is weak and America, you know, doesn't stand up for itself. And
that's what he thinks.
He calls it the terrorism bubble. It doesn't make any sense, you know, at all. It's the classic reduction of human reality to sort of clever sound bites.
Yeah. Yeah,
but that's what he's referring to.
Yeah.
But there's an example. I mean, and in the military, I mean, every fourth word is, you know, begins with an F.
Yeah.
It's just the more violence there is, the more sexualized the language becomes.
Yeah. And I suppose that's how you brainwash young men to kill.
Yeah. I mean, young men are... I found that the great dividing line is often between those who have children and those who don't.
Yes, of course.
And it's not accidental that the only person to actively intervene at the My Lai massacre to try and stop the slaughter of several hundred Vietnamese women, children, was a 20-year-old helicopter pilot who had children.
Yeah. I remember saying to my father when I was about 13, but Daddy, why do the men rape the women when they conquer a territory when the women have done nothing? And my poor father looked at me and he didn't know what to say, and I still don't know why they do it. Why do they rape the women? Is it because they've been inculcated, immersed in this sexual violence in order to kill, that when they get into a territory they find these defenseless women and they rape them? Is it a sort of conditioned reflex, do you think, Chris Hedges?
It's broader than that. It in war, in essence, what you do in a culture of war is turn human beings into objects. Objects to either gratify or destroy or both. The language of war is a language which dehumanizes the other, especially, of course, those defined as the enemy. So that by the time somebody is immersed in the culture of war, they have a kind of godlike power to revoke another person's charter to live on this earth. We used to say, you know, hand a 19-year-old kid an automatic weapon and it takes them 4 days to become God. And there is no impunity. I mean, killing is part of war. By that I mean the taking of a life of somebody who does have the capacity to do you harm. But murder is always part of war. The killing of somebody who has no capacity.
That's
to hurt
what you. War is. It's murder.
Well, especially wars, occupations like Iraq.
All war is murder, Chris.
Yeah, all war is murder. I mean, for instance, in the first Gulf War, where I went in with tank battalions, and yeah, I mean, murder is always part of war. But there is a distinction between killing and murder, in the sense that if somebody is carrying a weapon and is shooting at you, then shooting back is one act. If you walk into a village and there are women and children and you gun them down, then that is another act. And I think that, of course, these acts become fused together and take place at the same time. But I think for those of us who covered war, it's all appalling. But, you know, watching crazed units go in and with that sort of intoxication that comes with the power to destroy not only things but human beings, and then watching them destroy people who are utterly defenseless was always the hardest thing to have to witness,
yeah.
Especially children.
Oh, and then these men get back, and of course there are women in it now too, but the men get back never really to recover. Is it 50% have post-traumatic stress syndrome and never can fit back in their families, into society? They just are so alienated.
Because PTSD, what it does is it makes you numb. You can't feel. I mean, yeah. I went through this.
Did you?
You can't. Oh, yeah. I went through a horrible period. And you know, you can't sleep. It's that revisitation of trauma night after night. And it's like you get up in the morning and even just a shave becomes a kind of Herculean task. And you can't, you know, what Dostoevsky said, hell is the inability to love. And boy, that's what PTSD is. And if you can't reconnect, and it's very hard to connect, even with the people you love the most, if you can't reestablish that connection, then you're finished. Then you commit suicide one way or another, whether that means drinking yourself to death or, and, you know, I've watched friends of mine go through this, and it is... that's what war does to you. The longer you're in it, it renders you incapable of feeling.
It's really severe.
And once that finishes, you're finished.
Yeah, it's really severe depression, because I've been through a severe depression myself after my mother died, when I had similar lack of, I couldn't love even my children. And I think that's what it is. What was yours post-Sarajevo? When did you experience
By the time I finished, well, I did the war in Kosovo after Sarajevo, so it was just, I sort of broke down in Kosovo.
How long did it take to you to recover and get back your...
Three years.
Really?
Yeah.
I suppose with a lot of help, too.
Yeah, it took me 3 years to put myself together. And even now, you know, I have, you know, horrible... I mean, you just can't be around that many incidents of violence, and you know, you try not to think about it, but you know, it always will come back with a kind of fury at night. Like it used to. I mean, it used to just come in these horrible waves night after night, but it never goes away.
Do you dream about it?
Oh yeah,
it's in your hippocampus. It's in your hippocampus where memories are stored.
Right.
Oh dear, Chris. Well, look, I could talk to you for 24 hours. But I'm afraid we're out of time. You're a fascinating person.
Well, thank you for doing this.
And I want everyone to read his three, I think, well, he's written lots of books, but one is American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, published by the Free Press in 2008. War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, published by Anchor in 2003. And Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. Nation published it in 2009. That's the one I wanted to talk to you about, Chris. I think that's imperative that we discuss it. Perhaps if you'd be willing, we could have you on another program in the future.
Of course.
To talk about Empire of Illusion. Well, thank you very much, Chris. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I think we've only just touched the surface of what's the most important issue facing us all, particularly as now we're armed with nuclear weapons, right?
Yeah.
Well, good luck, Chris, and I really understand how you honour your father.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Today on If You Love This Planet, I've been speaking with Christopher Hedges, an American journalist, author, and war correspondent specializing in American and Middle East politics and societies. His most recent book is Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, published by Nation Books in July 2009. Thanks for listening today. If you want to follow up on other previous interviews, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. If you'd like to contribute to the program, there is a place where you can send in a contribution. And I look forward to talking with you and speaking to our next interviewee in a week's time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.